Welcome to the summer broadcast of Echolocation. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we're listening to the dawn chorus of both bird song and of the magnetic sounds of the earth. And I've got to say, where else would you hear the mixture of the earth's chorus and bird songs than WGXC? Only on Creative Community Radio will you hear the sound of the celestial spheres mixed with those that soothe terrestrial ears. WGXC brings a phenomenal mix of sounds to Greene and Columbia counties and beyond. This is the Radio Everywhere Pledge Drive, and WGXC truly is everywhere. The station delivers happenings of our local day-to-day lives, along with the marvelous sounds of our creative community. Call 518-697-7400 or visit wavefarm.org/WGXC to pledge your support of the station. Because if we all give what we can keep having a station that is truly by the people and for the people. So call 518-697-7400 to pledge now. I'll be reminding you during the course of the show to call in or go to the website to support Creative Community Radio. So if you pledge now, you can sit back and enjoy the show without feeling guilty every time I mention the pledge drive. So I got interested in doing a show on the sound of the dawn chorus when I came across the profile of Gordon Hempton in the book Environmental Sound Artists by Frederick Bianchi and Vijay Manzo. Gordon Hempton, who goes by the name of Sound Tracker, is an acoustic ecologist who has recorded soundscapes all over the world. And in 1989, Hempton came up with the idea to record the dawn chorus of birds in different parts of the world and edit them together to approximate the chorus moving ever westward as the sun rises across the earth. And the resulting cassette recording was a continuous and changing bird chorus, 24 hours of birdsong contained in a minute-long audio piece. And right now we're listening to an excerpt from a more recent recording from the Sound Tracker called Global Sunrise, The Musical Sounds of Dawn. And here's some information from the liner notes from Global Sunrise. I'm quoting here. Each day when the sun reaches 6 degrees below the eastern horizon, enough ambient light is created to distinguish objects and the avifauna begin to vocalize. This event is so well regimented that some bird species have served as early morning alarm clocks. Birds evolve to vocalize at dawn, presumably to take advantage of the transmissive, non-turbulent atmospheric conditions which are frequently present at this time of day. Vocalizations may range from simple calls to elaborate songs and serve a variety of functions such as territory identification, mate advertising, family bonding, etc., depending on the species involved and the season. Changing medleys of bird voices distinguish one dawn chorus from another, and the order of species vocalization further characterizes each locality. Insect feeding birds are the first to sing, and grain feeding birds are the last to sing. The composition of the dawn chorus is so expressive that it's possible to correctly identify a place, the season, and time of day on the basis of the recorded chorus alone. The dawn chorus, like dawn itself, has circled the planet as an endless wave for millions of years. In this respect, the Global Dawn Chorus is one long song with a composition that has paralleled the evolution and population dynamics of birds. It is precisely this perspective, planet Earth as a musical instrument, that Global Sunrise explores. So let's tune in to Global Sunrise for a little while here. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we've been listening to Global Sunrise by The Soundtracker. It's really cool that The Soundtracker first recorded the Dawn Chorus around the world in 1989. But another event, the International Dawn Chorus Day, is even older. International Dawn Chorus Day began in the early 1980s when broadcaster and environmentalist Chris Baines asked people to attend his birthday party at 4 a.m. so they could enjoy the Dawn Chorus with him. Today, people in more than 80 countries participate in International Dawn Chorus Day, which is held annually on the first Sunday in May. And you can check out the International Dawn Chorus Day website at www.idcd.info. More recently, a totally cool Dawn Chorus event is Reveille, which is a 24-hour broadcast of the sounds from live open mics and hydrophones around the world. Reveille coincides with International Dawn Chorus Day, which occurred on May 5th in 2018. And starting just before daybreak near the Greenwich Meridian, Reveille broadcasts pick-up feeds one by one, tracking the sunrise west from microphone to microphone, following the wave of intensified sound that loops the earth every 24 hours at first light. Reveille doesn't just pick up the sound of bird songs, however. It passes from urban rooftops to deep ocean hydrophones to remote forests in a 24-hour audit of the earth. And Reveille airs on WGXC and Standing Wave Radio at Waveform. Reveille is sponsored by SoundCamp, which is a London-based artist collective developing site-responsive work and research around ecologies of sound and place. And we're going to listen to an excerpt of an interview with the people behind the Reveille project, Grant Smith and Maria Papandomanoliki. Apologies if I mispronounced your name. Which aired on Making Waves, which is a show produced by New Adventures in Sound Art that airs monthly on WGXC. And we're going to listen to Maria and Grant describing Reveille on the Making Waves broadcast that aired on May 12th.
Tell us a bit about the Reveille broadcasts. What is that and what takes place?
We're just coming up to the fifth edition of the Reveille broadcast, and it's a 24-hour round-the-earth radio show that relays live feeds that are sent in by streamers as the sunrise reaches them at their locations around the planet. So Maria and I set up a pop-up radio station at Stavehill Ecological Park in London, which is right near the Greenwich Meridian at zero universal time coordinated. And starting at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning, we follow the sunrise or the daybreak west as the Earth turns towards the sun, and pick up a series of real-time audio feeds and basically just put them end-to-end to form a 24-hour loop. And that coincides with International Dawn Chorus Day, which is a project that preceded ours and is just a kind of a opportunity to mark the Dawn Chorus as a terrestrial phenomenon, I think.
Yeah, and it would be interesting also to add that this is, well, there is a crowdsourcing of resources and live streams, including special commissions. Every year we contact people and we invite them to commissioned them in some form to set up a stream, but also we have an open call, so everybody who might want to share their live Daybreak sound from their location, they can do so. And then also a variety of other sources, maybe less legitimate or acoustically hi-fi sources, video cams, CCTV cameras, air intercepts, hydrophones, which are all maintained and operated by marine bioacoustic centers, and all sorts of resources that you wouldn't necessarily use if you wanted a pristine birdscape or dawn chorus.
So as the time unfolds, one is hearing the Daybreak with different technologies, but also in different environments, but not just open-air field recordings.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. And then I guess some of these also happen in urban places too, I imagine, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are interested in that mix of the lo-fi and the hi-fi, the rural and the urban, the very urban, the very noisy, the very beautiful, the very chaotic. We have every year streaming from Kolkata, which is absolutely fantastic, and it's the way that it develops over time is, fantastic. So we are keen on bringing these lesser heard voices, to the foreground for just this one time every year.
When I was preparing for this segment, I happened to look up the definition of dawn chorus, and it turns out that the term doesn't only refer to birdsong, but it can also mean the song of radio waves in the Earth's magnetosphere. So, with a little bit of research, I came across a recording of the Earth's chorus on the NASA website, and we're listening to that now. According to NASA, I'm quoting here, chorus is an electromagnetic phenomenon caused by plasma waves in Earth's radiation belts. For years, ham radio operators on Earth have been listening to them from afar. Now NASA's twin radiation belt storm probes are traveling through the region of space where the chorus actually comes from, and the recordings are out of this world. And these recordings were made in 2012. This is what the radiation belts would sound like to a human being if we had radio antennas for ears, says physicist Craig Kletzlig-Zig, whose team at the University of Iowa built the electric and magnetic field instrument suite and integrated science receiver used to pick up the signals. People have known about the chorus for decades, says Kletzing. Radio receivers are used to pick it up, and it sounds a lot like birds chirping. It was often more easily picked up in the mornings, which, along with the chirping sound, is why it's sometimes referred to as dawn chorus. And as always, I'll post a list of references on our Facebook page, Echolocation WGXC. And speaking of WGXC, it's the Radio Everywhere Pledge Drive, and we really are everywhere, from around the world listening to bird songs and urban sounds in the dawn chorus to the Earth's magnetosphere. So please contribute. You can call 518-697-7400 or donate at wavefarm.org/WGXC. You think I'll run, not walk to you. Why would I want to talk to you? I want you crawling back to me. You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we just listened to a band called The Magnetic Fields with a song entitled You Must Be Out of Your Mind. And you must be out of your mind if you're listening to this show right now and you have not yet pledged to WGXC in the Radio Everywhere Fund Drive. So please contribute to Creative Community Radio by giving a call to 518-697-7400 or paying a visit to wavefarm.org/WGXC to pledge your support for the station. So now is the time in our show when we usually profile an echolocator, a mammal, bird, fish, or insect that uses ultrasonic sound to navigate and locate prey. but it turns out that a place that might just be in the WGXC listening area, Rensselaerville, New York, played a crucial role in the discovery of echolocation. So if there's anyone out there from Rensselaerville, this story is for you, or for people that happen to be a total bat or sonar geek. And welcome to the first ever edition of the Echolocator Profiler Profile. Our echolocator profiler is a scientist by the name of Donald Griffin, the man who coined the term echolocation in 1944. Dr. Griffin spent the summer of 1939 as a research fellow at the Edmund Niles Hike Preserve in Rensselaerville. The Edmund Niles Hike Preserve, and it's spelled H-U-Y-C-K, had just been founded in 1931 by Jessie Hike, who named the preserve for her husband, Edmund Niles, a felt manufacturer, entrepreneur, and civic-minded visionary who was born and raised in Rensselaerville and who died in 1930. In 1938, the Hike Preserve Board of Directors established a research station and formed a scientific advisory committee. And Griffin, who was a student at Harvard, was one of the preserve's first research fellows, and he did his early work on echolocation while at the preserve. He and his colleagues set up a laboratory in an old barn on the property. And Griffin had been studying bat navigation, and he began conducting experiments to try to understand how bats seem to see in the dark. Griffin created a bat flight room in a barn and hung piano wires from the ceiling. And then he captured little brown bats and set them free in the flight room. And when the flying bats hit the wires, it created a pinging sound. And Griffin counted how many times the bats hit the wires under normal nighttime conditions. And he then plugged their ears with wax and then counted how many times they collided with the wires and made those pings. And he also glued their mouths shut and repeated the experiment. He found that the bats' ability to avoid the wires was reduced by limiting their ability to hear and to vocalize. And from this experiments, he determined that bats emit high-pitched sounds that echo off of objects and help them to avoid collision with obstacles in the dark. After his summer in Rensselaerville as a research fellow, Griffin returned to Harvard and worked with colleagues who had developed an early ultrasonic detector that determined the high-pitched sounds that bats emitted were outside of the human hearing range. And this discovery of bat sonar built on the work of scientists who had been working since the late 18th century when Italian scientist Lazzaro Spanozzini put an owl and a bat in a completely dark room and found that while the bat flew effortlessly, the owl kept bumping into objects in its flight path. And Lazzaro determined that bats navigated using what he called a sixth sense. And Griffin had discovered that sixth sense in the ultrasonic clicks that bats make when they echolocate. Griffin spent much of his career as a zoology professor at Harvard, Cornell, and Rockefeller universities, making discoveries that deepened our understanding of echolocation. One of the really wild projects that he worked on early in his career was the development of the bat bomb during World War II. The U.S. designed and tested a weapon that consisted of a bomb-shaped casing with over 1,000 compartments, each containing a hibernating Mexican freed-tailed bat with a small timed incendiary bomb attached to it. It was meant to be dropped from a bomber at dawn over Japanese cities, and the casings would deploy a parachute and open to release the bats. The idea was that the bats would find a place to roost in eaves and in attics as daylight arrived, spreading over a large radius of at least 20 miles. The tiny bombs would then ignite and start fires in inaccessible places. Japanese construction relied on highly combustible wood and paper, and the vision was of a large, difficult-to-control fire breaking out in many locations simultaneously all over the city. it was estimated that a single bat bomb could start 3,000 to 4,000 fires, while a conventional bomb ignited only hundreds of fires. Testing of this bat bomb went through much of the war, but the work was suspended when it was decided that the atomic bomb would be used on Japan. Over the course of his career, Griffin saw echolocation confirmed not only in bat species, but in toothed whales, porpoises, shrews, oil birds, and swiftlets. And at the end of his career, he began to study the awareness of animals, and he engaged in a large scientific discourse about animal consciousness. He wrote and advocated for science to recognize animals as conscious and aware beings. And Griffin died in 2003. So who would have thought that the tiny hamlet of Rensselaerville would be so important to the discovery of echolocation, an amazingly cool bioacoustic feat, and of course the namesake of our show. So shout out to you, Rensselaerville, and if anyone's listening from that neck of the woods, let us know by messaging us at echolocationWGXC on Facebook. And in honor of Donald Griffin, here's a song by The Bats.
Where is the time?
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and Wave Farm Radio at wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we just listened to a tune called Antlers by a band called The Bats. And Donald Griffin, the scientist who discovered and coined the phrase echolocation, studied little brown bats when he was at the Edmund Niles Hike Preserve in Rensselaerville. And so we're going to listen to the echolocator profile of little brown bats, which first aired on the third echolocation show that aired on WGXC. And the show was called Does Fall Make a Sound? So let's take a listen to some information about little brown bats.
It's time. It's that time again. It's time for the echolocator profile. This evening, we're going to explore a mammal that flies through the air, the little brown bat. Bats are actually the only mammals that are capable of flight. We think of a flying squirrel, but they really glide. But bats actually fly. And they're an old group of animals. They're fossil records of bats that date back 50 million years. And besides their unique capability of being a mammal who flies, bats are echolocators. The ears of most bats are unusually long in relation to their body size, and there's a small flap on their ears called the tragus, and it probably has a role in the bat's acute hearing and echolocation abilities. Bats are not blind, but they are frequently flying around in the dark, so they depend on their unique sonar system, their echolocation ability, to locate and catch prey during the hours of darkness when they're active. Little brown bats fly around at night eating insects that are caught and eaten while they're flying. They mainly feed over water on small aquatic insects like mayflies and mosquitoes and caddisflies. And these insects swarm over water at night, so the bats can just fly through and catch and eat insects in these swarms. And they have to eat half their body weight in insects per night in order to prevent malnourishment. So it's serious business that the little brown bats are doing to catch their food. The little brown bats send out a steady signal of high-frequency sounds to scan the area, turning their heads from side to side and sending out sound pulses through their mouth. The sound bounces off objects and returns to the bat as echoes. And as they get closer to an insect, they'll send out more pulses of sound to get a very precise idea of where the insect is. And when they can directly find where the insect is located and zero in, they may use their tail or their wing membranes to scoop up the insect and put it into their mouth. And all the time flying very rapidly, they're scooping up and eating insects, and this enables them to consume up to 600 insects in 1 hour. Besides their echolocating clicks, it is thought that the little brown bats communicate with each other using chemical signals, as well as vocalizations that include honking, which may aid in preventing mid-air collisions among foraging adults. Little brown bats are found throughout the northern U.S. and Canada. And they live in colonies numbering in the hundreds of thousands of individuals. The colonies aggregate at nesting places called roosts. And there are several different types of roosts that serve different purposes. There are day roosts and night roosts that provide habitat for bats to sleep and rest. There are hibernicula, which is a type of roost that is occupied during the winter months. And little brown bats may choose buildings, caves, trees, rocks, mines, or even wood piles as roost sites. And they may migrate hundreds of miles to get from their summer habitats to their hibernicula. Little brown bats are polygamous, and males mate with a large number of females. During breeding swarms that take place in the late summer and early fall. And at this time, they will congregate in a succession of caves just before hibernation. And although the sperm is transferred to the female during mating, they actually hold the sperm, and ovulation and fertilization of the eggs are delayed until the females arouse from hibernation the following spring. During the summer months, the females form maternity colonies, and they consist of thousands of individuals, each individual having a single pup that is born in early summer and is fed milk like other mammals. And the little brown bat pups huddle together while their mothers go out to forage insects, and they are capable of flight in about 3 to 4 weeks. And then they must learn to forage for insects and become independent by late summer so they can put on enough fat to make it through their first winter. The relatively low reproductive rate of little brown bats indicates a longer-lived species, and individuals have been found to live up to 30 years long in the wild. And one reason for this relatively long lifespan is thought to be that the bats spend such a great deal of time in reduced metabolic activity during hibernation. Even during the warm months of the year, bats lower their body temperatures on a daily basis and enter a state of torpor to preserve energy. Their heartbeat and respirations will decrease during these periods of torpor, and it's thought to prevent some of the wear and tear on the body, allowing such a small animal to live for so long. Little brown bats have been a very common mammal in North America, but there are some conservation concerns about this echolocator. They are declining partially due to suffering from white nose syndrome, which is a fungal disease that affects hibernating bats and causes death. So, I'm always thankful when I see bats flying at night. Those polygamous, insect-gobbling, long-living, hibernating, roost-loving, echolocators are a welcome sight.
And now, in honor of the little brown bat and also all those Mexican free-tailed bats that were sacrificed with the development of the bat bomb, we're going to listen to a selection from Maria Elena Zita's Concert for Bats. And this track is called Dark and Sound, and it'll take us through to the end of this hour. And we'll see you on the flip side. Don't forget to donate to WGXC by calling 518-697-7400 or donating at wavefarm.org/WGXC.
Thank you.